worship series for this month is designed to help us grow deeper and wiser as God's people. And one of the things we've been talking about is that you don't mature just by following the rules all the time, but nor do you grow up and mature as a person by breaking the rules all the time. The way we grow will always involve sort of reordering, rearranging our lives in a new way in response to God's grace shown to us. I don't expect you to remember this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. In week one, several weeks back, we talked about the blessing of our mistakes, since our mistakes and our failures are often the events in our lives that open us up to something new. In the second week, we looked at our own lives as a kind of vineyard where God calls us not to be religious, because that's not all that important, but where God calls us to become friends and co-workers in a shared project of tending the garden. Last week, Laura helped us explore the parable of the wedding feast, helping us see that life with God is not about following rules, believing certain things, but it's more like being invited to a party and then showing up and celebrating with other people. In today's reading, Jesus is asked what looks to us should be a simple yes or no question. Is it lawful? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar? But rather than painting us a black and white picture, rather than laying out some clear guidelines and rules, Jesus answers in a way that is much more interesting, in a way that calls for us to change our lives. He calls us to reorder and rearrange our lives so that we become new people with new desires. He wants us to grow into the kind of life that gladly offers to God our first and our best loyalty. Here's the line I want you to notice. Give to God what is God's. What do you think? Give to God what is God's. There you go. It's as simple as that, right? I'm not even sure we need a sermon today. Just pay your taxes, like Alicia said to the kids. Pay your taxes, give the government what you owe, and then give to God what belongs to God. Okay, so now is everyone completely clear on what you're supposed to do as you leave here this week? I mean, why am I, of course, I'm just kidding. I would never be able to preach a 45-second sermon. And it is more complicated than that. Give to God what is God's. It sounds simple and it sounds easy, but then when you think about trying to do it, it gets really complicated. It reminds me a little bit of part of the workout at CrossFit on Friday. One of the assignments was to practice doing a handstand with your feet against the wall, but you have to get up against the wall first, right, to be able to do this handstand. So our instructor did it, you know, just facing the wall. He just jumped down his hands, his leg flipped up against the wall, said, do it like that, and, you know, hold yourself up for 30 seconds. He got down and said, all right, you know, I knew what I was supposed to do. I'd seen him do it, and I started to do it, and my brain just said, oh, no, you don't. You know, I got paralyzed. My body wouldn't let it thrown down and my legs flip over. And so he tried to coach me through this. It didn't work. Finally, he said, just bend over and put your hands on the ground. And then two people had to take each of my legs and lift them up over me and put them against the wall. That wasn't a joke. That wasn't a laugh line. But anyway, thank you for your support. So the problem with this simple sounding teaching, just give to God what is God's, right? The problem is that it isn't clear how we're supposed to do this. Jesus is asking us to learn to be faithful even in the midst of ambiguity. Here's the title of the sermon today, Learning to Live with Ambiguity. So I am to learn to patiently offer myself to God's new project in the world of healing and blessing everything, even when I can't figure out how it all works. It's tough to be patient that way. Jesus is asking me for a kind of loyalty that can't be motivated just by getting it right or following the rules or, you know, conforming to the expected behavior. What Jesus wants from me is for me to take responsibility for the shape of my life, for the shape of my loyalties, for the shape of my commitments. Now, on one level, this reading is about paying your taxes. And on that level, it shouldn't be all that hard for us to imagine what's going on. These people are in a heated debate about taxes. We know how this goes. We pay sales tax. We pay property tax. We pay income tax. We pay estate taxes, and we're used to paying our taxes, and we're used to grumbling about our taxes. Our family even has an additional tax. It's called the Halloween tax. It's a tax on the candy that the children bring home. The percentage differs year to year, but it's an important tax. In the case of the reading today, we have some Jews who are Pharisees, who typically, they want to be religious observant. In general, they try to stay out of politics. They don't like Rome, but they don't want to cause trouble either, right? So those Jews team up with the Herodians, right? Another group of Jews they don't normally team up with. The Herodians were full-on collaborators and supporters with Rome. They said, hey, you know, if Rome's in charge, let's just learn to get along with Rome, do whatever they need us to do, right? So these two groups of Jews try to trap Jesus in public and ask him a question about taxes. Like many of us, these two groups of people had settled into a way of life and a system that kind of largely worked for them. They knew what was expected of them. And they certainly didn't want Jesus, the troublemaker, shaking things up. And so they want to trap him with a question about paying taxes to Caesar, which was a dangerous thing to be talking about in public. Like Elisha explained to the kids, if Jesus says, yep, pay your taxes to Caesar, he would have lost support among many of his Jewish followers, who were frustrated with Rome as a violent, evil, occupying pagan force. On the other hand, if he said, nope, don't pay your taxes to Caesar, he would have been arrested immediately for leading a revolt against Rome. So instead of playing their game and answering it either way, Jesus says, anybody got a coin? They hand him a Roman coin. On one side of the coin was the head of the emperor. On the other side was an inscription that read, now listen to this, the inscription on the Roman coin is important if you're to hear the good news in this story today. The inscription reads, Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus, Pontifex Maximus. The inscription invites all of the Roman Empire to relate to the emperor as a god and to give to the political elite the kind of allegiance only reserved for the gods. Then Jesus flips the coin back to his opponents and says, give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's and to God the things that are God's. Notice that he doesn't call for faithful people to protest violent governments by refusing to pay their taxes. But he certainly does downplay the importance of political loyalty. It's kind of like he's saying, if the government wants a few coins, just give it to them. Pay your taxes, but don't spend your life singing the praises of any political regime. These two parts of Jesus' statement, I do want to point out, you're not to hear them in balance. Right? Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, give to God what belongs to God. Jesus is not trying to say, life should be a balance, you know, give half your allegiance to the government and half to God. That's not it at all. All the emphasis falls on that second part. That's where the real snag lies for us. Give to God what is God's. Jesus is asking all of us to learn to live by a deep and life-shaping loyalty to this newly arriving kingdom of love, and this is a hard thing for us to learn. But I suppose we often learn by experience in our lives. We start with rules whenever we learn anything. That's why I ask you, what kind of lessons did you take when you were a kid? Well, whatever it was you learned, you start with the very rudiments, right? You start with the fundamentals. You start by learning the rules. You remember in grade school, when you were learning handwriting and you had that paper with the solid lines and then the dotted line in the middle, and kind of makes me nauseous just thinking about it. I hated this as a kid. I did not like being told how to write my letters. I didn't have good handwriting. I still don't have good handwriting. You know, your capital letters were supposed to get all the way to the top, and your, what do you call them, non-capital letters? Lowercase, sorry, it's been a while. Wow. I need to go back to school. Lowercase letters get to the dotted line, whatever, right? But think about it. Now that you know how to write, right? Hopefully you're not thinking, I'm clearly not thinking about capital and lowercase letters, right? You just write, so it just flows. Same with anything else, right? If you learn to play the piano, if you learn to play golf, right? If any of you learn to play golf, there are lots of technical things, right? You got to get the stance right, your hips right, your feet right, your shoulders right, your grip right, right? The bend right. You got to get to the right spot back here. You got to rotate right and get through. You think about all that stuff when you're learning to play golf. But then when you get better, hopefully you're not thinking about all that stuff, right? Your swing would look terrible if you were trying to think about all that stuff. You just try to swing gracefully, right? You've sort of absorbed all the rules, but you've moved through them, beyond them, where it's just become part of who you are. You're just sort of swinging gracefully. Well, I think for us to hear and respond to this good news, that's what Jesus is calling us to do, to move through just wanting some black and white easy answers. Being willing to open ourselves to this difficult call, give to God what's God's. I don't think there's any easy rules, but I do think there's some guidance in this passage. So I want to end by pointing this out. There's a clue in our reading today, and the clue is the importance of our faces, okay? This attention to the human face is easy to miss in our gospel reading today, but it's certainly there. Jesus' opponents begin by flattering him in public. They say, Jesus, we know that you're not partial. We know you don't pay attention to the status of other people. What the Greek literally says is, Jesus, we know you pay no attention to the face. You pay no attention to someone's face. And then when Jesus directs our attention to the coin, he asks for a coin that bears Caesar's face, and he asks us, whose image is this? So here in this confrontation about loyalties, we have the face of Caesar on the coin, we have the faces of the crowds listening in, we have the faces of Jesus' opponents trying to trap and trick him, and then we have the face of Jesus himself. And here we are today, of course, with our own faces and the faces of those around us. So, just for a quick second, this is going to feel awkward. It's meant to be awkward. I want you to look around. I want you to look at people's faces. Go ahead. Look at other people's faces. It's really weird to linger longer than a minute or two, but you have my permission to do it. Not after this, not later, but just right now, okay? Notice the faces of other people. It will look different than your face. It's a different shape. It's a slightly different shade of brown. It has it brown. It has its own creases, its own dignity, right? The features are differently aligned. But in all these faces sitting around you is the wonderful and precious light and grace of God. Our faces carry our pain and our joy, our hope and our fear. And part of learning to be Christian is this practice of learning to see the rural, brown, Mediterranean, Jewish Jesus as the very face of God. In this wonderful, powerful, merciful life of Jesus, God faces us, and by God's grace, we find ourselves loved deeply enough and forgiven completely enough to turn ourselves to face the source of all this beautiful light. And now we're learning to face others with a new kind of compassion and mercy and kindness and hospitality. We're learning to see all other faces as the face of God. And every single face we encounter is asking for something. Asking for affection, asking for respect, asking for justice, asking for protection, asking for health care, asking for a meal, asking for a safe home, asking for good schools, asking for eye contact and a smile, asking for a little small talk about the weather, or some little nod that acknowledges that we really are all in this together. And if we can begin to see all other faces as the face of God, perhaps some of the difficult dilemmas of life will begin to release their tension. And while there won't be rules, right? There won't be clear-cut rules. Maybe in other people's faces we can find some energy and some guidance as we move forward. Let me just give you a few examples as I end here. What kind of career paths would our young people choose if they imagined themselves gladly living face-to-face with other people, each person serving the other and making a contribution to the community out of their areas of giftedness? What training programs, what career tracks, what college majors would our young people pursue if they could see the beauty of God shining in their own faces, and if they could imagine bringing delight to the faces of others when they use their gifts well? Would that be different than how much does this profession make? What would our retirement look like if we truly appreciated the wise experience etched in our own faces and the faces of our friends and neighbors and others that we might serve in this new chapter of our lives? How would I spend my money and my free time and my extra energy here in our own community if I tended to the faces of all others who live here as the precious face of God? Men, in a culture where women are often degraded and harassed, how would we relate to women? How would we talk to women and talk about women if we were to practice seeing in all faces, men's faces as well as women's faces, the beauty and the light of God? I am afraid that Harvey Weinstein's problem is not just his, but it might be a little more widespread than that. How might our views of patriotism and protest change if we were to tend to the face of a soldier or a veteran who's been in harm's way and made enormous sacrifices? Or what happens when we tend to the face of a black mother who's lost a child, or a black athlete from a difficult neighborhood who kneels simply as a way of asking not to be shot by police when unarmed? And what will happen to our patriotism if we tend to faces that are Mexican, Somali, Russian, Iraqi, or Chinese? Surely these faces are precious to God too. And surely all these faces taken together complicate and enrich what patriotic loyalty might look like for a Christian whose ultimate and first allegiance cannot ever be to one country's flag. What kind of health care would I advocate for if I have in mind the faces of people who are ill or severely disabled or need extra care? What kind of tax policy would I favor if I have in mind the faces of those whose work does not even provide them with enough to live on? What kind of immigration policy would I support if I have in mind the faces of those who want exactly what I want, that is, a safe place to live with a chance to work and support their families? And how might we become better members and friends in this congregation if we were to tend to all the other faces who gather here with us each week? All of them different from our face, but each of them, like us, seeking gladness, acceptance, meaning, friendship, love. Well, you already know that I don't have answers to any of these questions. I'm just wondering whether the face of Jesus Christ and the faces of others might make a difference in the shape of our own loyalties. So, pay your taxes and give to God what belongs to God. Amen.